nine, eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one. We have ignition. We have liftoff. Out and about is a go. All systems are nominal.
Hey there, out and abouters. You are listening to KYRS Medical Lake, Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM, or perhaps you are streaming from KYRS.org. I think all systems are indeed nominal because our antenna is back after a snowmobiling trip high atop Mount Crumpet to get it fixed, and we are here in the studio, and I have Chris Armitage and Dan Brown, and we're going to talk about a new book that Chris has written. But first, let me just turn on some microphones so you guys can say hello.
Hello.
Hey, this is Chris.
All right. Thanks. So we're going to dive into this book, which sounds fascinating and a tome for our time as well. But I wanted to... First, I think I want to do this every week till we get through all the chapters. Just spend a couple of minutes talking about the book On Tyranny. And that I'm sure this book you've heard of before. It costs about $2 used. It's nothing. It's at the library. And it's very quick read. But there's tells you basically how to survive during times of tyranny. And the first chapter says, do not obey in advance. In other words, do not preemptively surrender things to people, thinking that they'll go easier on you because you've surrendered them, or that now that you've said yes to a little thing, they're going to enter into some kind of negotiation with you and be, tone it down a bit or maybe be a little fair-minded. Well, that's not going to happen. So do not obey in advance like we've seen so many people do. And also maybe part of it is make them take it away. Make them pay the price of having to take something away from you rather than giving it to them. Even though it is, I know we want to avoid conflict, but also be prepared to see those who love and you admire. Maybe surrender, but take some solace that they stood up for even a moment. And you can be one of those people that people will admire as well. So, Chris.
Yes.
Hi. We're here to talk about your book, Tyrant in a Top Hat.
Yes.
Now, that's an interesting title. That's an interesting title. And it's an interesting looking book. I mean, the cover looks a little spooky.
Yeah, it almost looks like a horror movie.
It is. Well, book cover. I guess it is sort of like about mass murder.
Oh, definitely. A lot of death.
Why don't you just tell our listening audience what, in broad brushstrokes, and we'll do a deeper dive, what the book is about?
Well, it's another look at the legacy of Abraham Lincoln and of the Civil War. I wrote this book because I was really, really upset about a lot of things lately. And so looking back at some of the historical reasons for, touch points and how we ended up here. And that book covers those touch points. And I think one of the most pivotal moments in our nation's history, and then the last two chapters cover where we are today and where we could go, which is particularly relevant. I wrote this book when I wrote it for a reason because, spoiler alert, a big part of the book is actually about secession.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I think Abraham Lincoln is such an interesting figure who just keeps popping up. Usually as a good guy, although I think there are people who are having more and more problems with him.
Yeah.
Native Americans certainly have a problem with...
44 pages of the book is dedicated just to his treatment of Native Americans.
Yeah, but right now, he wasn't... I think he was dead by the time by the 14th Amendment was passed. But that 14th Amendment is sure a big deal right now as far as we're looking at citizenship and what that means. So he pops up for that. I remember when Obama was first in office, a Committee of Rivals or whatever that name of that book was, where it was like, oh, he gathered all these diverse thinking people around him. And was that true? Is that part of him true? Did he do that? Or
Yeah, he's this mythical figure. He's been deified. He's literally on Mount, Mount Rushmore. But you know, there's a lot more to it. You know,
yeah.
He may have been an effective leader. He also fired General McClellan because General McClellan, who was very effective and beloved by his soldiers, said, "Hey, I value the lives of our soldiers. Also, I don't just want to kill civilians and burn down entire cities. That I don't believe that that's a moral or just way or to wage war. And I think we can win this war without having to do that." And he said, "Well, if you're not going to burn down cities then and kill civilians, then we're just going to fire you." And that's what he did. And then McClellan ran against him and had a lot of great points. And if he'd been 6 months early, if the war had just shifted in 6 months in either direction, things might have gone differently with that election.
You know, well, and I guess the crux of this, a lot of people think that the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln started the Civil War to free the slaves. Is that true, Chris?
So Abraham Lincoln, early in his run for the presidency and after he was president, regularly made statements explicitly saying that white people and non-white people cannot cohabitate peacefully together. He supported something called the Corwin Amendment, which would explicitly guarantee a constitutional amendment, explicitly guaranteeing that all states that held slaves could continue to hold slaves. The Emancipation Proclamation left 500,000 enslaved people in the Union still able to have their slaves. So he freed the slaves where he didn't have political or didn't have legal control, and didn't free the slaves where he did have legal control. He explicitly said, "I do not care about freeing slaves. If I could say preserve the Union without freeing a single slave, I would do it. If I could preserve the Union by freeing every slave, I would do it." He just cared about preserving the Union above all else. And you know, it's funny, he has this reputation, they say he's the great orator. Well, in all of his speeches and debates, I only was able to find one example of him saying why preserving the Union mattered above anything else, even slavery, you know, even saying, "Hey, maybe we should stop having enslaved people." And that was, he said that it would just result in the United States falling to anarchy.
So you think that was the whole reason why he did it, was to kind of, I mean, it was the desire to avoid anarchy? Or do you think he really, why do you think he was so motivated to keep the southern states part of the United States?
He was a religious zealot. He was someone who believed that marriage, union, any union of any kind was holy and unbreakable and should be retained at any cost. 15,000 political dissidents in the Union were jailed for just speaking out and saying, "Hey, if a nation wishes to, you know, if people remove their consent to be governed for whatever reason, that's how this United States was founded. Why would we not grant that to others?"
I didn't know that. So there are people who actually, just for using their First Amendment rights,
with no trial, habeas corpus. Yeah,
that's pretty interesting. I wonder if there's, as you've seen more and more people kind of flock to an authoritarian figure as president right now, I wonder if there's some sort of deep seated desire by the majority of Americans that want to be ruled, that want to be told to shut up.
Yeah. Well, that's fair. I mean, I think, you know, that I wrote this book because of what's happened, the current political climate.
Yeah.
I'm very disappointed with a lot of things, but I decided to try and channel that into something that might be useful. And what happened with, you know, the Civil War, the war was not inevitable. Everybody says the war was inevitable. No. Southern states held held conventions. They had overwhelming support. We're talking about 90% of people who, even when offered a constitutional amendment to guarantee their right to have slaves, still said no. We're going to draft our own new constitutions. We're going to leave the United States. And the only difference between our constitution and their constitution is that it explicitly says white people are better than black people. That's factual. There's a famous cornerstone speech that was given by a major Confederate leader. They loved their racism so much that there was, as soon as Abraham Lincoln was elected, they said, "Okay, we're going to secede." It was because he was elected. There was nothing he could offer them. He offered them everything he could. And they sent diplomats, they held conventions, they drafted their own constitution, they talked about how to handle debt, and then Lincoln ignored them And then in letters and correspondence that he had, he said, I know that if I send a resupply to Fort Sumter, it will start a war. They will have to attack us. And that's fine because what they're doing is illegal and wrong. And it's just, it's terribly disappointing that that's the path he chose, because the book addresses a lot of alternative routes that we could have taken to address slavery and to free enslaved people that would have been more effective, could have happened quicker, and wouldn't have required absolute tyranny. The death of 750,000 dead in the United States when it was so much smaller population-wise than it is today. Cities burned to the ground. I mean, imagine if you know, 90% of Washingtonians voted to leave the United States because of some things we're not happy with the federal government.
Yeah.
And the answer was to burn down Spokane and have, you know, martial law.
Right.
I wouldn't be happy about that. I don't think you would either, right?
No, and what, you know, you mentioned some different routes to kind of remedy, you know, to get rid of slavery. Is there one that you think would be the most probably favorable or likely? Or
yeah.
Which one?
Well, I think what would have been the most effective strategy, and I, by the way, I co-authored this with my father because we've had conversations lasting many hours over the years about
this
exact subject.
So this is a seed that's been planted a long time ago.
Yeah, we've been chatting about it for years, so I just started taking notes and we wrote it together. But the route that I think would have been best, most ethical, most true to the principles this nation was founded on, because when it was founded, even George Washington said slavery is a scourge that's antithetical to the founding principles of this nation. But to get the South on board, we're going to need to just kick the can on it. And so the better route would have been meet with the diplomats from the Confederacy, let them go their own way, but tell them, hey, all right, a huge portion, more than half of the income coming into the Confederacy is coming from cotton exports. Well, guess what? France and England, they already got rid of slavery. They don't like it. And so we're going to start talking to nations that, you know, are abolitionist, and they're going to stop importing from slaveholding nations. Well, guess what? This exact thing happened during the Civil War. Anyway, the South went from selling 4.5 million bales of cotton per year to selling 500,000, and that did not come back after. So that happened anyway. We could have applied economic pressure and said, hey, so now your slaves, I mean, if you want to have them pick cotton, fine, but nobody's buying it because what you're doing is wrong.
Yeah.
And second of all, any slaves that run away, they can come here and have 40 acres and a mule because we believe in freedom.
Oh, okay. Yeah. May offer that incentive.
Yes.
To escape.
We could have made it explicitly about abolition.
Yeah.
We could have done it without waging war. Slaves, you cross that border, we're going to take care of you. We're going to give you land. We're going to give you all that. And we're going to negotiate on the world stage because you got one cash crop, and we're going to put that economic and diplomatic pressure so that you don't even have cotton. Why even pick cotton? Because nobody's buying it.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I sometimes I think about, you know, the advances that were made in agricultural machinery and technology. I wonder how much longer would have slavery lasted.
Yeah,
it's an abhorrent institution, should have never been established to begin with. But I wonder, just with the technological advancements, you know, just the cost benefit of feeding people and all this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wonder, you know, and it seems like the South really, I think I look at that time too, to look at like, well, what people can do, the bad things that they can make out of a good religion. You know, it seems like that was part of the South strategy. And I think a lot of people think that the North was very enlightened as far as slavery, but I was listening to an author who wrote a book about Sherman's March and our Stonewall. Sherman's March, yeah, Sherman's March to the sea, and how freed slaves joined the march, basically, and they weren't really welcomed. In fact, they would sometimes burn the bridges behind them so they couldn't follow them up north.
Yeah.
So I think it's a real romanticized thing that we have going on.
Yeah, I think if some real moral, I don't think it's moral courage to wage a war because you don't think that You know, everybody should be under the banner of the United States. You can't leave this union. That's not, I don't respect that. What I respect is actually looking at something strategically, respecting consent to be governed if the people of an area overwhelmingly vote for something, and looking at other ways to handle emancipation that wouldn't have resulted in so much death and destruction. It might have even been more effective.
Did Lincoln have any advisors from other countries or anything that were kind of like saying, hey, you know, maybe you should think twice about this? Or was he pretty much, because I think about, I don't know if Lincoln ever read the letter, but apparently Karl Marx was a big Lincoln fan.
Yeah.
And wrote letters to him. And I don't know. I mean,
there was a lot of, you can't look back through the records and not find overwhelming reverence for him. Yeah. And to me, it just feels baffling when I look at the facts of the situation.
We had conversations early on about a lot of the myths around Lincoln, and I think one of the first ones that I mentioned was that he never thought that blacks could ever be integrated into white society, and that he anticipated that they would either be shipped to South America or Central America or Africa. It's an idea that Jefferson also had, 50 years before then, and also came up with the idea that buying off the slaves.
Yeah, and Lincoln actually took a note from England and offered $400 per slave to slaveholders for them to free their slaves. And they said no, because, again, they loved their racism more than anything else. They loved being able to have slaves. And I just don't get wanting to share a country where that is an overwhelmingly... Yeah. I don't want to share a country with a place that's overwhelmingly popular. And this has been a through line since the founding of our nation, is that bigotry has been worth fighting and dying for half of the country in an overwhelmingly popular sentiment.
Well, don't you think, too, that there's this almost like this paternalistic, like God has granted me these slaves, and I will be a benevolent person in the sight of God, and I will be this paragon of virtue, which is, I can't say the word on air, but it's wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that we run into that even today, where I have had people that I've known in my life who were conservative Christians, which I use that term Christian really loosely in this context. But their thing is like, I don't like the government taking my money to give to people on welfare. I would just as soon, if they move into my house, then I can watch them and make sure that they're actually behaving themselves. And, I think that is a really awful comment on people when they, and it's weird because I think they're being very generous, but really they're just awful.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I don't have any incentive here to not call it exactly what it is. And then half this country loves this control, loves telling other people how to live their lives, loves condescending, loves feeling like they're better than people. Because like Jesus, he pulled out the whip and whipped the people selling things in the church. He did not pull out the whip on people begging for food.
No.
And that's a fact. These people are hypocrites. The words of Jesus, you ever heard of the Jefferson Bible, actually?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Kicked out
all the magic. All the magic out of it. Yeah. And just what Jesus said. Also, red-letter Christians did the same thing.
Yeah.
That was actually really popular in the days of the Founding Fathers, was to make your own version of the Bible where you would cut things out. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, deism during that time. And I want to ask you, and we'll have to cut to a break, but I want, I think one of the things that I think about, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this seems like a greater magnitude, of course, is that, Roosevelt, I love Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And, but, he did inter Japanese Americans.
Yep.
And it's weird when we try to juxtapose these people into our modern time, but it sounds like Lincoln, from your perspective, and correct me if I'm wrong, sounds like Lincoln was a lot worse than that.
All bad. Yeah. I don't really feel there's any redeeming qualities to the legacy of Abraham Lincoln when you really inspect it.
Yeah.
That's really how I feel. I think a big part of why he's been deified is just because people were afraid, like, oh, what if states decide they want to secede again? We better not be too encouraging about that.
Well, I told you earlier on that I was surprised when I first went to Richmond, Virginia, that, you know, I thought that the South called the Civil War the war between the states, but in Richmond, they call it the War of Northern Aggression.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know who called it that, too, I think, was Granny on the Beverly Hillbillies.
Right. Right. And they have the wonderful Museum of the Confederacy there, right at the end of Monument Avenue.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's, well, we're going to break for our 20-minute after the hour stuff, and then we're going to come back. I didn't even dip into all the questions I wanted to ask you because we're having which is good. We're having a great conversation here.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to load up some stuff. And speaking of Lincoln, we got a little Lincoln music here, and we'll play that while I'm loading up some stuff, and then I'll start doing our stuff.
My pappy said, son, you're going to drive me to drinking if you don't stop driving that hot rod Lincoln. Have you heard the story of the hot rod race with the Fords and Lincolns was setting the pace? That story is true, I'm here to say I was driving that Model A. It's got a Lincoln motor and it's really souped up. That Model A body makes it look like a pup's got 8 cylinders and uses them all. Got overdrive, just won't stall. With a 4-barrel carb and a dual exhaust, with 4 living gears you can really get lost. Got safety tubes, but I ain't scared. The brakes are good, tires fair. Pulled out of San Pedro late one night, the moon and the stars was shining bright. We was driving up Grapevine Hill, passing cars like they was standing still. All of a sudden, in a wink of an eye, a Cadillac sedan passed us by. Said, boys, it's a mark for me. By then, the taillight was all you could see. Now the fellas ribbed me for being behind, so I thought I'd make the Lincoln unwind. Took my foot off the gas, and man alive, I shoved it on down into overdrive. Wound it up to 110, my speedometer said that I hit top end. My foot was glued like lead to the floor, that's all there is, and there ain't no more. Now the boys all thought I lost my sense, and telephone poles looked like a picket fence. They said, slow down, I see spots, the lines on the road just look like dots. Took a corner, sideswiped the truck, crossed my fingers just for luck. My fenders was clicking the guardrail post, the guy beside me was white as a ghost. Smoke was coming from out of the back when I started to gain on that Cadillac. Knew it could catch him, I thought it could pass. Don't you know by then we'd be low on gas. We had flames coming from out of the side. Feel the tension, man, what a ride. I said, look out, boys, I got a license to fly. And that caddy pulled over and let us by. Now all of a sudden she started knocking it down. And she started to rock. And I looked in the mirror, red light was blinking. The cops was after my hot rod Lincoln. They arrested me and they put me in jail. And they called my pappy to throw my bail. He said,
son, hey there, folks. Join me for a musical trip along Americana Avenue. Now on Wednesday evenings from 6 to 8 p.m. Hear the greatest progressive songwriters from yesterday and today. Each week I'll feature a specific artist and a vinyl spin of the week. It's music that plays to the human condition, Wednesdays at 6 on Thin Air Community Radio.
This is your KYRS live and local calendar for January 25th through the 30th. Saturday, shower with friends at Arborcrest, Ronan Keys at Huckleberry's, Carly Fairbanks, Automatic Shoes, and Time Worm at J-Bones Music Land, Shauna Nicholson at the Garland Drinkery, Blake Braley and TJ Hoops at Zola, City of Ember, Thunder Gun Express, and Her Memory at the Big Dipper, The Wild Feathers and Nathan Graham at the District, and Chuck Vibes, Spooky, Cruel Velvet, and Prod Synesthete at the Chameleon. Sunday, All Ages Blues Jam at Fired Up Pizza in Chihuahua, and Steve Starkey at Iron Horse in the Valley. Monday and Tuesday, Open Jam at Jackson Street. Tuesday, the All-Star Jam with Jerry Lee Raines at Zola. Wednesday, Liam Russell at Iron Horse in the Valley, Aki Fumikato at Zola, and Open Mic with Derek Hart at the Checkerboard. Thursday, the Sydney Dale Band at Zola and Dope Throne at the Big Dipper. For an entire hour of local musicians, tune into Sounds of Spokane every Sunday night at 8 on KYRS.
Hey, this is DJ Downlow from Inside the Hype Radio. Thousands of people choose KYRS as their radio station every week, and we want you to be a part of our family. Just text Give KYRS to the number 44321 and make KYRS your radio station.
KYRS reminds everyone to stay away from fallen power lines and treat them as dangerous live wires. Call the local power company to notify them of the location of any downed power lines. In case you've been listening, you can tell that's my favorite PSA right now. Okay, Out and About receives support from Boots Bakery and Lounge, specializing in vegan bistro fare and gluten-free baked goods, located in the Saranac Commons, 19 West Main Street. Open 7 a.m. through 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, 7 a.m. through 5 p.m. Sundays. Full menu and information at bootsbakery.com. Out and About receives support from KSPS's PBS TV's Inland Session series every Monday at 7:30 p.m. on KSPS PBS Channel 7.1 and streaming at KSPS.org. Inland Sessions episode archive and podcast featuring extended interviews and stripped down performances available at KSPS.org/Inland Sessions. Welcome back, everybody. I've got Chris Armitage here. If you're looking at it, it's Christopher Armitage and Dan Brown, and we are talking about Chris's new book. And Dan's sort of he's the front man. He's the, you know, I wouldn't
bodyguard.
Say, I don't know, would you say you're the muscle or the brains behind that? What would you put your?
I just try to contain his enthusiasm and keep him aimed at the goal.
That you're really, grounding. You're sort of a grounding
right.
force. Yeah. Very nice. Very nice. We all yes. need that in our lives. do you do that? Can other people hire you up for that, Jim?
Anytime, yes.
Okay.
Well, right. So I might be looking you up too. For that.
Now, we for neglected to ask or to tell people, I neglected to ask you how to tell people how they can get this book.
So you send an email directly to Jeff Bezos and you say, Mr. Bezos, no, it's on Amazon and you just type in Tyrant in a Top Hat, Unmasking the Leader Behind the Legend, or Tyrant in a Top Hat, you know, Armitage, Armitage, and, you know, or just you can email me and I'll send you a link, OakShield8@gmail.com. And same for also if anybody has more interviews or questions or anything. I think this is a really good book that I wrote. Yeah. I think people would like it.
I'm getting excited about it. I might have to go on there and just a stinker and a stovepipe. That would have been a good title too.
Whoa. You know, I love alliteration so much.
I do too.
Homonyms, alliteration.
I do too. Alliteration is where it's at. All my last painting was Grounded Grizzly Greeting. I just can't avoid it. so, you know, Abraham Lincoln was quite a figure on the national stage. I mean, people turn to America, a lot of hope. Are there any kind of modern day figures, political figures that kind of come to mind that when you think of Abraham Lincoln and his legacy, anybody that comes to mind?
Definitely. Saddam Hussein. 100% seriously, Saddam Hussein. Not engaging with the will of the people, treating your own nation as a place for military occupation, arresting people and putting them in jail without trials who own newspapers in your country because they release articles that disagree with you, firing generals because they don't want to kill civilians. Definitely Saddam Hussein. I mean, I look at the imperialist bent of the United States in the modern era, and it's hard not to see that kind of originating mostly with Lincoln and his obsession with manifest destiny and the insolubility of the Union. I think Lincoln was gross and a bad president. I think he was one of our worst presidents. But, you know, that competition is hot. So we'll see how it goes. But, I mean, three quarters of a million people dead when there were a lot less Americans than now. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. It's what do you think, like, what do you think he was like as a person? Do you have any idea, like, what did people think about him? Like, yeah. You know, one thing, there's always been these rumors that he was gay. Do you find any?
He did share a bed with a man.
Yeah.
It was, I think, see, it's my understanding, and please weigh in here, and Dan as well, feel free to weigh in. It's my understanding that the modern conception of gay and not gay is really almost non-existent before like the last 60, 70 years. And that even then men would have sex with men and women would have sex with women. And although throughout history, apparently which position you were in was maybe likely to get you more or less respect. But as far as like, you know, people loving people of the same gender, it was seen as not really that. And that's much of the world now. When I was in the Middle East, I was told that explicitly. I was told, hey, they'll stone you to death for, like, loving a man. But if you make love to a man, well, that's common. They do that all the time. Most of the Middle East, that's viewed as, like, you know, men are for pleasure and women are for babies. And
yes, yeah, I've heard that.
A lot of cultures throughout history and in the modern era view it that way. A bit more romantic, if tyrannical, but romantic. Like, don't well, love them.
People also, there's a lot of evidence that Lincoln was seriously ill, that he actually had Marfan syndrome,
yeah.
And probably wouldn't have lived much longer anyway.
Yeah,
that's true. So I guess, and I'm sorry I short-circuited my own question, but as far as like people who would come up to him and knew him, how do you think of as a person? How was he?
He's probably a good guy. Yeah. On like a personal level, I think he was really misguided. Although Saddam Hussein was responsible for almost 100% literacy level in Iraq.
Yeah.
Right when he took over, he loved reading, and he said, his goal was to have 100% literacy in Iraq. And Lincoln, everything I've seen seems like he was a pretty nice guy, and people liked him. And, and from a queer history perspective, he had some very fond, you can find some of his most fond correspondence being related to his feelings with other men.
Yeah, you know, it's weird. We watched this movie the other night. Lee, have you seen this movie?
No.
And it's not Lee from the Civil War. Lee, who was a photographer during World War II, and she was a fashion model, but she was the one who, her photographs had gotten lost over the years, but they were, a lot of the Auschwitz photographs were hers and things like that. And, but she also went into Hitler's apartment where he lived and took a bath in his bathtub. And that's probably her most famous picture. But there was this juxtaposition in this film of these horrible things that she saw that was the architect of this horrible thing, who was Adolf Hitler. But in the same time, his apartment was really nice. It was nicely furnished. And you could probably imagine having a nice conversation with the guy who lived there. But there's these things that these people who would otherwise maybe come off as okay do horrible things. And maybe that's where that we are with Abraham Lincoln in this.
Yeah. I mean, that's, how do you define a monster or a tyrant, or, you know, all these different things? You can, you know, you could, if you had the book of someone's life, anyone's life, and you could read every detail, you would certainly find things to empathize with. But the war wasn't inevitable. He should have respected the South's right to be governed, or to, you know, to withdraw their consent to be governed. He could have found tons of other. I mean, gosh, imagine if he'd said, okay, go be your own country. We're going to, you know, work on economic sanctions related to emancipation. But also, why don't we just make a whole North American union? Mexico, Canada, another way to do Manifest Destiny. We got these four countries now in North America, and we will just all back each other up militarily, and we'll work on some trade agreements together, and us in Canada can help, and Mexico can help push back against the slavery thing with the Confederacy. Yeah. Lots of other options there. Yeah. Uncreative and with a passion for absolutely brutal measures to get things done. That's Abraham Lincoln.
What kind of drove you to start in on this project? I mean, was it something that you'd always wanted to do? You mentioned your dad.
Yeah.
And you talked about this a lot.
Me and my dad have had a lot of conversations. We co-wrote it together. I'll just also say I'm so lucky to have two of the greatest parents anyone could ever ask for, and also awesome brothers. But we've had all these conversations because for years, we've talked about how why keep the South? Why force them at gunpoint to stay as part of this union when this fight that we've been having this whole time? Imagine how much progress we could have made as a nation if we didn't have so many of these states trying to drag us back into the past and stay slaveholding and prevent civil rights. What would that nation be if we just let them go?
Right. And I guess even when you look at the original Constitution, the compromises that had to be made by the northern states for the racism of the southern states really was very much their racism.
That we're still do.
And then we're still living with the Electoral College and all of that.
Yeah, this country has had the same problem the whole time it's existed. And I am tired of every 4 years having to be terrified because the presidency shouldn't be a position where every 4 years half the country's terrified and half the country's terrified because they believe some really stupid things. But, that is the fact of it. You know, I'm friends with a lot of libertarians, a lot of them. And one of the things they say that I really like is the presidency shouldn't be so powerful that we have to be scared who becomes president.
That's a fact.
Yep. Because honestly, I'm not scared of, even if a Republican got elected in charge of Washington state or something, like at the state level, at a local level.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you can sit down with the mayor. You can go yell at a city council person of any political party.
Yeah.
You're never in your whole life going to meet a president unless you maybe really work hard to do that. It's so detached from the needs of the people. So I wrote this book because I am so upset at the state of the world now. I mean, I cried a lot. I'm gonna be honest, I cried a lot after the election just because I was like, well, there's all these different groups of humans who will suffer deeply. And now I try not to watch the news, but I channeled it into this book because I'm sick of this. We need to separate. We need to go our separate ways.
Yeah.
I am all on board Cascadia, whatever it is.
Right.
They don't want to be with us, and we don't want to be with them. And I said it off mic, and I'm going to say it on mic. The South is a dog turd in the fur of what this great nation could be, and we got to cut that out of the fur. I'm done with them. Let them be their own country. They want it. Let us be our own country. I want it. And we need to get more progressives and lefties on board for that, too.
Yeah.
And we need to do it loudly because things are going to get a lot worse and a lot more gross and a lot more horrifying. And if you want to do it, I don't have faith that this system is going to be fixed any other way.
Yeah, it was when you were writing the book, was there anything that more than anything else that just struck you like, oh, I didn't know that in your research that you went like, man, I had no idea.
Yeah.
An item.
Yeah, no, that's I got to learn a lot writing this book, which was great. Just to get in depth on the subject. I mean, one of my favorite details was the Corwin Amendment. And just the steps that, Lincoln did really take to try and make the South happy. He said, hey, Corwin Amendment, we'll give you a constitutional amendment. Anywhere you have slavery, you get to keep slavery. And the guy who did that, the South was like, no, he wins. As soon as he's president, we're seceding. There was nothing he could offer them to stop them from seceding. And they tried to do it peacefully. I did not know before this that they sent diplomats. They held statewide conventions. They drafted new constitution. And again, the only difference between that constitution and our constitution is it didn't just say we get to keep slaves.
Yeah.
No, it said white people are better than black people. That's what they wanted in writing on their constitution. And that's what he thought was worth fighting for. He thought it was worth putting a gun to their head to stick with us. Gross. Terrible. Yeah. I'm mad at him.
What was this? Why didn't the South want to do that? That seems like that would have been a pretty good deal for them.
Well, I mean, most conservative politics today is all about being disagreeable more than having your own stances. Secession was just overwhelmingly popular. They were like, you know, hey, we left England and now we're ready to just leave and be our own country. Yeah. We don't like sharing. They felt that they were fundamentally incompatible with the North.
Wow.
They were right.
Yeah, they were. And it's funny because, when you're in Washington, D.C., the South is right there.
Yeah.
I mean, the South, it's like you think Washington, D.C., you think, oh, Beltway, Insider, Northern stuff, but it's right there. I mean, it's hard to believe that people that close would have such a big disagreement. When, what is your, and Dan, I'm going to ask you about this process too. What's your process like writing? I mean, you write on a computer. Do you go through like three or four drafts? Do you have a certain time of day that you like to write more than other times? Or?
First of all, I'll say Dan the book's dedicated to him also. I put him as the sole dedication. He was absolutely instrumental because the process for writing this book was basically with all my books that I've written, I wake up when I wake up, no alarm clock, ideally. I'm not allowed to do anything else except for write, and I do all my writing standing up in the kitchen, and sometimes that's 8 hours. I can't leave until I hit my word count for
the
day.
What's your word count, Dave?
5,000.
5,000. And you on computer?
Yeah, on my laptop. I've had the same laptop for 6 years. I bought it in Mexico at a Walmart 6 years ago. It was.
Now, what a workhorse.
A lot of these start with our conversations, too.
Absolutely.
And then after you do the writing, then you send it to me and send it to other people and get input and do an auto modification.
Yeah, actually, in this book, I was a little bit more loose about the word count thing. I was more into chapters, but I was really hoping it would be at least 50,000 words.
Yeah.
Ended up being 12 chapters. And if I felt like, cool, I hit the... I mean, I'm not allowed to go do other stuff until I hit either the word goal or the chapter goal.
How about like when you start doing the second and third drafts and all that, do you have a benchmarks for that too?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I have to not hate it. I mean, I wrote this book, I wrote four chapters that didn't make it into the book, for example. I read this book itself five times, start to finish or different chapters, multiple, like I just keep going through it until I don't hate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that is a very...
That's hard to do because the more you read it, the more you go like, ugh. Yeah.
I'm emotionally attached to my work. I mean, that's part of the reason like I haven't done book signings and stuff and hope to in the future, but making a thing and selling a thing are two very different things.
Oh, absolutely. And Dan, when you are watching Chris work, how do you support him in that, as far as do you just kind of stay away, or what do you do?
Well, no, I like to just let him run his course, give me the output, then let it sit for a while, do some reaction, chat about it, then go back and do the modification.
Yeah, he'll say if something seems repetitive or like it's already been covered, or if it's good that it's been brought up again, or particularly with this book, since he's so knowledgeable about it. Because my dad's part of the book, I mean, I put all the words down, but he's the co-author without a doubt, because we would have 2-hour conversations on the phone for weeks where I would take detailed notes. Now, when I write that chapter, since this was more chapter based than word count, it's full of typos and spelling errors. And I basically try to just shut off any conscious part of my mind. I look at my sources, I structure them out, and I just go. I just put the words down, because it is easier to turn an ugly 20,000 words into a really nice 10,000.
Yeah.
And I found that it's like, if I can just get it out and not be mad at myself, because Ernest Hemingway said the first draft of everything is crap. That's an actual quote.
Yeah.
So I just got to get that. That's the toughest one to do. Right. The editing is easy.
Well, then you have, I always feel like, because I have a novel and book of poetry and all that, but I always felt like when I was doing this that I created this marble or this block of wood that's somewhat in the shape I want it to be, and now the real carving starts.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where the real work, and it's, to me, that's the fun work.
Yeah, editing is where it gets to be good. That's what I realized. My first two books, I don't like them, honestly.
Really? Okay.
I had trouble editing emotionally, when I did oil paintings as a kid, I would literally cry because I'd be so mad that the paint didn't look how I wanted it to look. Yeah. And I'd keep trying to change it and it would never get there. So I had trouble editing my first two books, and I don't have the $5,000 to hire a line editor.
When you were a kid, when I was a kid, I was such a believer. I believed, I would go to the Hall of Presidents and be on the verge of tears.
Yeah.
I was so, I guess, I wouldn't say malleable, but I really wanted to believe.
Yeah.
And I could see probably you were that
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely. Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt. I read a 1,000-page book on the relationship between Teddy Roosevelt and Taft. I mean, because also, you know, having a good relationship with my parents, like I feel like they had, like, I don't know, I didn't respect my teachers, but I respected my parents and I respected the people they respected. And
yeah,
we would have really good conversations too about like politics and stuff. Even at like 10 years old, my parents would say like, oh, you read, Thomas Paine this week. You know, why don't you tell me what you thought of that? And they would take it very seriously. You read Marx this week, or, and them giving, you know, me and my brothers that, like respect and really listening helped a lot. And then, yeah, I mean, the reverence for, like, I mean, Teddy Roosevelt, I love Teddy Roosevelt. I love Thomas Paine. Thomas Jefferson, as flawed of a figure as he is, I have,
was
like,
there
emotional.
A point when you loved Abraham Lincoln?
Never. No, I've actually always thought he was kind of a loser. I'm going to be honest. Yeah. I never during my life did I think, wow, that guy, smart or cool or anything. No, I think he was a loser. I think Thomas Jefferson was awesome and Teddy Roosevelt. And
so no one was ever taking you for like the one man show.
I don't get
you
liking Lincoln. That. I don't know.
did you ever see the movie, the Lincoln movie?
The Daniel Day Lewis
one? Daniel Day Lewis one.
No, but I'm going to send him some letters and a script, and it's going to be.
That would be funny. I guess right next to Lincoln, what was it? Zombie Killer or Vampire
Hunter? Vampire Hunter. It's supposed to be a good movie.
Well, let's tell people how they can read this book.
Go to Amazon and type in Tyrant in a Top Hat, Christopher Armitage, Armitage, or Tyrant in a Top Hat, Unmasking the Leader Behind the Legend, or email me at oakshield8@gmail.com. I can send you a link, answer questions, do interviews. This is a good book, and if you get it, you will like it. I am really confident about that.
Well, I tell you, I'm just proud. And it's hard for me because since the first of the year, I've decided I'm not buying anything from Amazon.
Oh,
which I have been on this. I mean, like, if you would see, I get the dopamine rush so well, you know, I'm like, and every day I would have stuff coming, usually art supplies and things like that, projects and things, but I kind of gave myself a little carve out to give myself permission when it's something that's specifically going to help me fight the fight that needs to happen right now. Maybe I can put that into this category.
I wrote this book because I want us to secede and I want to fight for secession. Okay. And I need to get the lefties on board because it's like, you got to, I don't know. I mean, the radical folks have been saying for years, we're not going to be able to make this work. And the system is so done. Yeah. And it should be real clear from this last election, we're not going to fix it, you know? And so it's,
Well, my only worry I have right now is that this whole state of liberty or whatever, where they want to take, you know, Eastern Oregon and Eastern Washington and put it into Idaho.
Yeah.
That to me would be horrific.
Well, actually that wraps really well into the last two chapters of the book because, public policy is a passion of mine. If there's a through line between my three books, it's public policy that aims to be apolitical or that, every side of politics could probably get on board with.
Yeah.
And that is true. Like, you know, I mean, I hate the South of the United States. I feel that way.
Did you spend much time down there at all in the service when you were in the service?
Went to some cool training. I mean, I made a bunch of friends. I was on a flight to Florida recently and made friends with these good old boys and we were drinking. We got drunk on the flight and they said some things that were definitely like racist and sexist, but like we had some drinks and we laughed a lot and we found plenty of common ground. I'm just mad about a lot of things right now with all of this. And
well, they kind of offend, you know, the way our system's built, it hasn't done them any favors.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really sort of,
they don't want the favors though. They don't want good education. They don't want those things.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, it's sort of like, I always think that the worst thing that happened to like the Tea Party people and all that is that they got what they wanted. Same thing with the Trump people. It's like, well, now we all know what a disaster your beliefs are.
But even during the Civil War, it was patsies. It was these poor, you know, most white people didn't own slaves, but they were ready to go to war for it over the overwhelming majority. I'm done with subsidizing the dummies in Louisiana. Yeah. I am. I'm done with that. This New York, Washington, California, we make the money in this country. I'm done with them. I'm done with the other places. And so it's,
you know. Well, you know, you guys are both really politically active. And I mean, I'm sure this book really, this book has sprung out of that. But what, is there something, you know, as we kind of talk a little bit about what's going on right now in the world and in the United States, particularly every day, it's sort of a new, like, holy cow. Really? I mean, you know, and how are you staying sane and staying active and
he's staying sane because he does not listen when I tell him things that happen every day.
Yeah, I don't want to hear it. I do that. I've told everybody in my life. I deleted all my social media.
Yeah.
I don't look at the news. I told all the people in my life I don't want to hear about it. I want secession. I want to do interviews about secession. You can give this book to conservatives. They'll like it, too. You can give this book to libertarians. They'll like it, too. Really. And, I mean, I'll tell them that, and we'll laugh about it. Like, I've said these exact things, joking around with whoever, you know, and we got to go our separate ways. It's such a bad situation right now, and none of us are happy in this union. So it's time for this union to go its separate ways. Now, you mentioned the Liberty State thing and all that. Uh-huh. Part of what I lay out in the later chapters is the things that a federal government would still manage, and kind of a shift towards a European Union type model, or a freedom union for the dummies out there who can't accept that being called a European Union style model, is that we would basically guarantee freedom of movement and maybe some, you know, try to help provide resources or incentives for people who are like, if we're over, you know, we're, you know, Cascadia and the Liberty State, and the Liberty State's like, no gay people allowed. And then, so, you know, queer folk want to move. That freedom of movement should be guaranteed through force if necessary. That is a case where it should be guaranteed. And even when I say, like, with force if necessary, it's because in the case of the Civil War, even back then, runaway slaves, give them freedom, give them all of that if we're two separate countries. But that's a different model than
so now. So you basically have your sights set on this project of secession.
Yes.
And so you don't care about anything that's really going on right now.
Exactly. Because it's all just like, it's dumb.
Okay.
No.
And okay, Dan, how about you?
I have decided that I just want it to crash. I want the people who are currently in power to run the country so into the ground that we have to start over and redo it. And I think that's our only hope.
Do you think that the people who would run it into the ground would be able to connect the dots? The people who support them, like, would say, oh gosh, maybe that was a mistake to support this. Do you think that's ever going to happen?
No.
Well, we don't know for sure. Wait.
I don't either.
Well,
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, it's going to be, oh, you know, I wanted this and I wanted that and I wanted this. And oh my gosh, gasoline is $50 a gallon and eggs are $100 a
dozen.
Damn
Democrats.
Darn those transgender people. you know, I mean, it's just, I just think that's what's going to happen because they aren't paying attention already.
You know, under Stalin, there was...
I love any sentence that starts under Stalin.
Yeah, okay, under Stalin, people were literally resorting to cannibalism. And there was billboard campaigns, don't cannibalize your family members when they die. And still, tons of Russians were like, those damn Americans. Like, they were fully on board. Same idiots as today.
I keep harping on this book that I've been enjoying called They Thought They Were Free. And it's out of Germany. Mm. It's a great book. And it's written, they interviewed people who had to join the Nazi party and during World War II and their stories of how they got there and et cetera, et cetera. But all to say, in the end, you think that people said, oh gosh, you marched me through Auschwitz. I guess I made a big mistake. Nope, they didn't think that. So let's do one more time. Let's talk about how people can get this book, then I got to get off the air.
Tyrant in a Top Hat. Search it on Amazon or Venmo me $10,000 and I'll just self-print. I'll print it myself and you can buy it from me. Tyrant in a Top Hat on Amazon by Christopher and Martin Armitage.
You know, I have to say, of all the people that I've interviewed, no one has ever asked for $10,000 over Venmo before. And so I think we have covered some new territory here.
Heck yeah. I don't want to work for Bezos either, but he just makes it really easy to self-publish.
It's tough. Yeah. It's really weird trying to make that work. Well, I want to thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
And for sharing this book. It sounds incredibly wonderful. And I just want to tell everybody listening right now, you are listening to KYRS Medical Lake, Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. And thank you for listening. And I'll see you next week.
Bye, sweeties.
Bye.
Thank you. You're so good at this. You make it.
In the 1787 Constitutional Convention, the framers were clear on what they were not creating: a monarchy. One delegate expressed the group's absolute conviction that the founding document must exclude even, quote, the fetus of monarchy. Yet, 238 years later, watching Trump's inaugural week, it was both awful and comical to see the royal pretensions of King Donald. There were silly gestures like him waving around a ceremonial sword, made more ludicrous by the fact that he was a cowardly rich boy draft dodger. Plus, there was the spectacle of him imperiously signing stacks of orders, proclamations, and pardons in a show of kingliness. Petty pomposity aside, though, he's an untethered megalomaniac whose inaugural speech reasserted such monarchical concepts as the divine right of kings and manifest destiny. And let us not naively dismiss Trump's flat-out claim that the Constitution gives him, quote, the right to do whatever I want as president, or that he previously suggested termination of the Constitution to return him to the White House. Indeed, he now contends that he can unilaterally terminate a bedrock constitutional right, the 14th Amendment provision guaranteeing citizenship to everyone born in the USA. He has royally and unconstitutionally decreed that children born here whose parents were undocumented immigrants are not citizens but, quote, aliens. This is Jim Hightower saying, well, at least there's the 22nd Amendment, which makes clear that he cannot be president again, right? Maybe. Trump is already suggesting his royal court might find a way to keep him in power, just as they're now contriving to void the clear citizenship protection of the 14th Amendment. Despots don't obey constitutions, they pervert them, and we the people must reject the perverters. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack. Find us at jimhightower.substack.com.
This is KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, heard at 88.1 and 92.3 on your FM dial, as well as worldwide on the internet at kyrs.org.
KYRS Medical Lake and K222BG Dartford, 88.1 FM and 92.3 FM, Thin Air Community Radio.
The following program was pre-recorded.
New York, this is Democracy Now!
It's a slippery slope when we think it's okay to suspend the Constitution of the United States in order to make a political point or statement.
As the Trump administration ramps up immigration raids across the country, cities are pushing back. We'll go to Newark, New Jersey, and Chicago, then to the Congo, where Rwandan-backed M23 fighters have entered the eastern Congolese city of Goma.
Le peuple congolais ne cédera ni à la résignation ni à l'injustice.
The Congolese people will not cede to this injustice. We will continue to defend our rights, protect our territory, and demand respect and sovereignty. History will judge the world's response to this call.
We'll also look at the civil war in Sudan, where a drone struck a hospital Friday, killing at least 70 people. And finally, Holocaust survivors mark 80 years since the liberation of Auschwitz. We'll speak to the Israeli-American Holocaust scholar Roz Siegel about Gaza and his latest article, Genocide Denial in Holocaust Studies. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department Monday fired over a dozen officials.